I'm speaking to Vanessa Tate, the author of the new book, Poor Workers' Unions, available from South End Press. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So I want to begin with, what is a poor workers' union, and how are they different from trade unions? And maybe you can give an example of a poor workers' union in answering that?
Sure. I use the term poor workers' unions basically for a variety of independent labor organizations that developed outside what's considered the conventional labor movement in the U.S., outside of what the AFL-CIO, basically. And many of these groups grew out of organizations that fought for civil rights, women's rights, the welfare rights movement, immigrant rights, and contingent worker rights. And it's an amazing and really a little-known history of organizing that started in the early 60s and has continued all the way up until the present day. During the 60s, a lot of these groups were doing organizing experiments. For instance, the freedom unions that were started by civil rights groups like SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and CORE, the Congress for Racial Equality in the South, and then there were also civil rights-based jobs campaigns in the North. And there were also feminist labor groups organizing clerical workers all around the U.S. The civil rights jobs campaigns, for instance, engaged in really massive civil disobedience in a lot of northern cities, and they won these really big victories. For instance, here in San Francisco, in the San Francisco Bay Area, back in 1964, those activists sat in, and sometimes they even slept in the lobbies of these big corporate hotels, and they won jobs agreements for the people of color who worked as maids and janitors and cooks and those type of jobs in the hotels. There were hundreds of these job agreements that came out of this activism, and there were also independent efforts to organize domestic workers in several cities, such as Atlanta and Detroit. Feminist groups also organized domestics and clericals, and they focused not just on things like pay increases, but also on things like respect on the job, free child care, and fighting sexism. And mainstream trade union organizers weren't doing that kind of thing. So this was very different. About the same time, welfare rights activists were organizing around issues concerning welfare, like a guaranteed national income. And so there was a whole explosion of organizing around the issue of class and poverty within social justice movements. And the issues went beyond economics. For instance, in the early 70s, welfare rights activists founded a group called the Movement for Economic Justice, and they organized both employed and unemployed people, people on welfare included, in this very broad way, not just for adequate welfare and good jobs, but for things like good housing, good health care, affordable child care, things like that. And into the 70s and 80s, there were similar kinds of organizing happening in cities across the U.S. where the community organizing groups were active. One of these was ACORN, which you may have heard of. ACORN stands for Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. And they were active in a lot of union campaigns, independent union campaigns for poor workers. There were also independent workers' centers, like the Chinese Staff and Workers Association in New York City. So ACORN did some really incredible organizing, and it turned out very successful organizing of home health care workers. These are the people, the home health care workers, who take care of elders and disabled people in their homes, and they're extremely low paid and really dispersed because they basically work in people's houses. And no union had been interested in helping them organize, but ACORN did, and thousands and thousands of them, specifically in Boston and Chicago in the early 80s, got union contracts. And now, of course, SEIU, which that stands for the Service Employees International Union, has become really famous for this kind of organizing of home health care. But they got the idea from the ACORN unions, which had been independent when they launched their organizing in the 80s, but they later affiliated with SEIU and brought all that knowledge of how to organize these kinds of workers into the SEIU. So There were also, ACORN organized several fast food outlets, including McDonald's and Burger King. And in one case, they even won a contract. It was the very first contract ever for low-paid fast food workers in the U.S. So, you know, there's this very rich history that's really interesting. These were all groups of workers that trade unions hadn't paid much attention to, that is, immigrant workers, undocumented workers, or what you call in Canada non-status workers, women in textile factories or domestic work and so forth. And in the 90s, when workfare came into vogue, you know, basically workfare is forcing welfare recipients to work in return for their benefits, community organizations in lots of cities began helping them organize for their rights. And it really took off. I mean, these workers are massively exploited. They have problems, like they're forced to handle hazardous wastes without protection, and they don't get any real wages. Basically, they simply get their benefits in exchange for their work. And they have been joining workfare unions by the thousands in organizing campaigns in many cities, including San Francisco and New York, which are two of the cities I cover in the book. So basically, that might give you an idea of what I mean by poor workers' unions. They look at all the issues in workers' lives. So instead of being limited just to jobs, they look at housing and health care and racial and gender discrimination. And for immigrant workers, language discrimination is a big issue, and issues around citizenship. And they bring all these into their organizing work. So their outlook is really different from the mainstream trade union movement, which tends to be very workplace-based and really is too often, unfortunately, can be very narrow and just concerned with wages and contracts. So in the 60s and 70s especially, but really up to today, so much of the trade union movement is very bureaucratic and top-down and sometimes driven by its staff rather than by the workers. And there are exceptions, of course. There are locals in many unions that are doing great rank-and-file-oriented organizing. But in many ways, those are exceptions. And union membership in the U.S. is now pretty low. It's now down to 12.5% of all workers in the U.S., and that's overall. It's even lower in the private sector. It's around 9% in the private sector. And that's the lowest it's been since the 20s. So there's a real crisis, as most of your listeners probably know. And the examples of these poor workers' unions and the way they organized, how they involve people and how they frame the issues can really help the labor movement, I think, you know, look at some more innovative organizing tactics.
So maybe you can talk about that. What can the labor movement learn from poor workers' unions?
Well, I think the poor workers' unions really show us, they are a part of the labor movement, but they show us a different side of it. They show us a vision of what the movement can be, and I think what they show us is that it can be grassroots, it can be very creative and adventurous, and really infused with ideals of social justice and equality. The fact that poor workers' unions organize people across industries, rather than just specific workplaces. Say, for instance, the Chinese Staff and Workers Association in New York, they organize garment workers alongside restaurant workers. Or ACORN in the 70s in New Orleans, they organized hotel workers and domestic workers together. That's a radically different model from traditional trade unionism, because traditional unions are usually very limited to a specific workplace or industry or a specific kind of job. So the kind of work that these poor workers' unions do in organizing really broadens our conception of what a labor movement is. And I think they've challenged the labor movement to broaden its conception of workers. And they've also broken down racial, ethnic, and gender stereotypes about organizing, about, you know, who's organizable. And all that is really important in terms of diversifying the labor movement. And one sign of this, one very positive sign, is there's a group called Jobs with Justice here in the U.S., and there are dozens of chapters of this organization across the country, and it's an alliance of community groups and unions, and they work in this broader way, looking at all the issues rather than just jobs. And it's a really powerful kind of coalition. Also, the way that the poor workers' unions grow from kind of grassroots, bottom-up, community-based organizing, they're run and owned by their members. And that's something pretty inspiring for the conventional trade union movement, which the trade union movement is itself democratic, but today, more often than not, I think the U.S. trade union movement is more of a formal democracy where, you know, workers might get a vote at a convention, but they're often not really deeply involved in decision-making around organizing, and they should be. And certainly there are people within the labor movement, the traditional labor movement, who are pushing for that to happen more. But poor workers' unions, this kind of historical trend that I documented in the book, they really rely on their members to do the organizing and the thinking about organizing. And so in the process, they really empower people because unions, you know, empower people in the way that they're, you know, people learn how to do social change, and they learn basic lessons about how you can change the world around you. So I think that's really important. They promote a culture of inclusion and solidarity. And this is an idea that originated in the labor movement itself, but is now proving to be, we've got to revive that idea so that the labor movement can rebuild its strength. So it's just important because, you know, one of the things the labor movement is trying to do today is have a new sense of vision so that it can be put, it can kind of take the lead as a more major social movement in the U.S. And, you know, to have that kind of vision, I think you have to look at all these issues that are important to working people that aren't limited to just jobs, but also include, you know, issues like affordable housing, good health care, rights to free speech, all these kind of other issues that are important to working people, and make alliances with movements that advocate those kind of issues. So I think that kind of networking is really the best chance we have to rebuild the movement. And if poor workers' unions and the labor movement, the trade union movement, can kind of get together on these issues, we'll just be a lot more powerful.
How are poor workers' unions facing the various challenges of multinational capital, globalization, and the threat of outsourcing of jobs?
Well, one of the poor workers' unions formations that's done most on that are worker centers. And worker centers, there are a number of them across the U.S. For instance, in New York City, Chinese Staff and Workers Association, again, one I mentioned before, they organize garment workers. And during the 90s, a lot of garment workers in New York City, even with union representation, really had horrible wages. I mean, they were paid by the piece, and often that worked out to something like a dollar an hour or even less. And even though the union contracts they had didn't protect them from, like, corporations outsourcing their work, corporations leaving and, you know, basically leaving them unemployed and even without their pay, the worker centers have tried to combat this. They haven't been entirely successful in preventing it either, but they have been able to get the workers involved, large back pay and overtime settlements for workers whose shops have closed, and that's a big success. So what they do is they use these really high-profile community fightbacks where they get lots of media publicity. They use the courts as well to force corporations to pay workers what they're owed. For instance, when a corporation closes or exploits workers in the plant. And in the book, I tell one story, for instance, of a group of seamstresses in New York. They occupied their factory until the contractor agreed to pay them the wages that were due. And basically, they did a sit-in. And in another case, this was in the mid-90s, Chinese Staff and Workers Association organized for 2 years, and they won over $250,000 in overtime pay for workers who were exploited very badly by this employer. And out here on the West Coast, there are groups like the Asian Immigrant Women Advocates, another worker center. They did a big campaign against some of the big-name fashion designers to hold them accountable for subcontracting their sewing work to sweatshops. So, you know, there are successes, even though it's, you know, it's always a fight. It's also important to remember that some kinds of work are extremely hard for even the most powerful multinational to outsource. Things like tourism, service work, restaurant work, healthcare, by their natures, these kinds of services really have to be done locally. That gives workers power because it can't really be outsourced. For instance, one of the stories in the book, hotel workers organized with the help of Acorn in New Orleans in the late 70s against the Hyatt Corporation. And Hyatt is a huge multinational chain of hotels, and they won. They basically organized for a union election. They won it at the New Orleans Hyatt Regency, and that was the first union victory in the New Orleans hotel industry in 20 years. So, there are definitely stories of victory on the issue of globalization and multinational capital, but there are big battles ahead.
What is beautiful about your book is that it shows a history of how the so-called unorganizable have been organizable through poor workers' unions. One such group is that is often very much exploited are undocumented workers or people of non-status. Could you talk about how people of non-status have organized through poor workers' unions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are lots of examples that are inspiring. I guess I can just tell you one of them. For instance, a workers' center in upstate New York called the Workplace Project. Most of their members are Central American immigrants, and they're on Long Island in New York, and they've had several successful campaigns for day laborers. Day laborers are people who are hired for just a day to do construction, landscaping, sometimes domestic work. And in lots of communities, immigrant workers, lots of them who are undocumented or non-status, hang out on street corners waiting for employers to come pick them up and take them to the job site. In New York, activists at the Workplace Project organized their local street corner in Hempstead. That's the city on Long Island where the Workplace Project is based, and workers have been getting paid as little as $30 or $40 a day for a very long day of work. Basically, the organizers got all the workers to agree that they wouldn't go with any employer who offered them less than $60 a day, which is, a little bit better. It's not great wages, but it's a lot better than $40 a day. So they simply decided to have collective solidarity with each other, and they convinced each other to do it, and it worked. So in that case, wages on that street corner went up by about 50%. Pretty quickly, just because people insisted on working for higher wages. And organizers told me it took a lot of energy to keep that going because as new people came in and old ones left, you had to re-educate people about it. But any union takes energy, even when you have a contract. So the Workplace Project also organizes direct actions against employers who, if they cheat day laborers out of their pay. So they'll do things like show up at the employer's home with noisemakers and TV cameras and, all that kind of stuff, and basically embarrass them in public in front of their neighbors. And this is really successful. Usually it means that the employer will pay the worker, the wages that they've cheated them out of. The Workplace Project has also organized worker cooperatives for landscapers and domestic workers, and that way the workers have a lot more control over their own work. Then they can negotiate a better wage, and, they basically run the thing with their coworkers instead of being at the mercy of an employer. So most of the activists doing this kind of organizing are not only immigrants, but they're undocumented or non-status, which is, in the U.S. without a visa. And what's really amazing is that there are huge numbers of undocumented immigrants in the U.S. Estimates that the latest estimates are there from 6 to 12 million undocumented workers in the labor force, and that's 4 to 8% of the U.S. labor force. And they're in industries like restaurants, manufacturing, service work, agricultural work. But they're often really militant activists, in part because they bring organizing experience from their home countries, where they may have already have organized in unions there or in human rights movements or political parties. So sometimes they're really the best union activists.
I would like to now talk about the writing of this book. How did this book come about and what went into the making of the book?
Well, I've been working as a radio and print journalist for lots of years, and had done a lot of stories on organizing during the, you know, the 90s and so on. And I covered a lot of workfare worker stories, covered workfare centers. And I was also a union activist in my own union, where we had all sorts of battles over democracy and organizing. And it always seemed to me, in looking out, that the community-based groups that I'd been covering really had a lot of creativity and energy, and that we in the conventional trade union movement were often lacking that. I mean, we tended to have long, boring meetings, and a lot of the community-based groups would have these great, you know, attention-getting direct actions that captured people's imaginations. And it just seemed to me that the labor movement needed to look at these ways of doing things and, you know, these new ways of getting people involved. So when I became a graduate student in sociology, I did a lot of reading about, you know, labor history in the 20th century, the Knights of Labor, the CIO, the Wobblies. But there really wasn't anything that similar to the kind of multi-issue organizing that these worker centers and workfare unions were doing. So I started looking at other movements like civil rights, feminism, welfare rights, and they all had these very interesting historical precedents, you know, for what I came to start calling poor workers' unions. I learned, for instance, that workfare workers in New York City had organized back in the early 70s, and they'd had very similar issues to workfare workers who are now organizing in the U.S. So I tracked down as much information as I could. You know, I interviewed dozens of activists. I searched for things in archives. And over the course of about 3 years, I think I went to probably a couple dozen archives in the U.S. And then activists who were involved in the campaigns and who I interviewed, a lot of times they would give me names of other activists to talk with. And slowly, so much evidence emerged that it was pretty obvious that this kind of poor worker organizing had been going on under the radar, as it were, for a very, very long time. And so some of the people I interviewed had ended up, by the 90s, they were working in more traditional unions, so they brought this community-based history that they had learned with them into traditional trade unions, and now we're seeing some important changes in the AFL-CIO, I think in part because of the kind of activism that these activists who were involved in community-based organizing in the 60s, 70s, and 80s have brought into the AFL-CIO. I just think it's important, the sense of continuity that all these poor workers' unions, they have been a part of our history since the 60s. It's important to know that, because too often, as activists, we just reinvent the wheel, and we think we're the only ones who've had to deal with a particular issue. But I think, you know, in looking at these histories, it's easy to see that there's a continuum there, and we can learn from it.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Vanessa Tate.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being here.
That was an interview with Vanessa Tate, author, about her new book, Poor Workers' Union, a look into the labor history of the other labor movement, one that organizes domestic workers, undocumented immigrants, workfare laborers, one that organizes in a way that is grassroots, participatory, and through the community. Read the book to learn more.